new home.
Mr. Roth, good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Robert Roth, representing the appellants, which are all Medicare participating hospitals. I have asked to reserve 5 minutes for my rebuttal. This appeal presents three interrelated issues. The first is whether federal courts have jurisdiction to determine if the 180-day time period to administratively appeal a Medicare Part A payment determination is subject to equitable tolling. Second, whether the 180-day period is subject to equitable tolling. The resolution of these two issues involve two unassailable presumptions established by the Supreme Court that the government has not come close to rebutting. The first is that agency action is subject to judicial review. In an effort to prevent review of the apparently improper governmental action, the government lawyers argue that the presumption is rebutted by an unessential footnote in this court's decision in Athens, in a decision that actually held that jurisdictional dismissals of Medicare Part A appeals are subject to judicial review. This is a slender reed indeed on which to base the preclusion of judicial review, particularly whereas here the secretary, the agency itself, told the hospitals that judicial review was available. The second presumption is, as Judge Griffith, as you stated in the Menominee case, is that time limits for suing the government are presumptively subject to equitable tolling. Here, the government unconvincingly tries to fit the 180-day deadline into the Brockamp factors. However, the 180-day deadline here is concededly by the Secretary.
Can I back up and ask you about the jurisdictional question? Now, in Athens, we held that the district court has jurisdiction to consider board determinations that it had no jurisdiction, provided the applicant met the threshold requirements of, what's the provision, 00F1. What are those what's the threshold requirement?
The threshold requirements in 00F1.
Right. And what are they?
Are 60 days from the date of the issuance of the final decision in a court with the proper venue.
Right.
The 180-day issue, as we explained in our briefs, is in 1395-00A3,
yeah,
which makes no reference to final decisions, judicial review, any of those indicia. Mm-hmm. So the requirements in F1, in our case, have concededly been met, where they weren't met in the John Muir case, mm-hmm, because that hospital did not appeal within that 60 days.
Within the 60 days.
Okay. So the
key to our reaching the equitable tolling issue is footnote 8 in Athens, isn't it?
I think the footnote 8 in Athens is helpful here, because I think even if you are troubled by footnote 4, the question here is whether the facts here show that the hospitals were timely and met the 180-day deadline.
So one has to resolve what the criteria for timeliness are.
Correct.
And then whether they met it. Right.
Yes, and that timeliness then takes you either in the first place or in the second place to equitable tolling. And again, as this court said in Menominee, you have the Brockamp factors. There's no question that the 180-day limit is non-jurisdictional. That's what the lower court found. That's what the secretary has accepted. And that also, when you're looking at the 180-day limit, it's simply stated, not emphatic, as in Brockamp. You have a circumstance where the language there is procedural, not procedural, and substantive. And essentially, the 180-day deadline, as set forth in 1395-00A3, does not come within those Brockamp factors. If the court would decide then that equitable tolling applies to Medicare Part A cases generally under the 180-day threshold, then the third issue that the court would get to is whether the deadline should be equitably tolled under the facts of this case, which concerns the Medicare disproportionate share hospital payment, which is a special add-on for hospitals that serve a high percentage of indigent patients. And in considering whether equitable tolling shall apply to this case, there are three essential factors that the board, that the court should consider. The first one is that it is undisputed that this particular Medicare payment determination is one that is determined unilaterally, wholly and exclusively by the secretary. Hospitals don't play any role in this. Generally, what happens if hospitals request a payment and then they get the payment and they're in a position to determine whether that payment matched up with what they requested? Not here. For this particular provision, it is the secretary that is wholly responsible for making that determination. And of course, the determination that we're talking about is the percentage of Medicare patients at the hospital who are also entitled to Supplemental Security Income, SSI, benefits. Now, there are several instances in the Medicare Act, in Title 18 of the Social Security Act, where the Secretary makes unilateral decisions and where Congress has explicitly provided that they are not subject to judicial review. For example, annually the Secretary calculates the weightings of these DRGs, diagnostic-related groups or categories by which payments are determined. Those are unilaterally determined by the Secretary, not subject to judicial review. Here, and the hospitals are not aware of another instance where you have a payment determination that is both unilaterally made by the Secretary and for which Congress has not prohibited or limited judicial review in any way. So there is no shielding here. The third unusual special circumstance of this case is the findings that were made in the Bay State decision. In the Bay State decision, you had a group of hospitals that went to challenge this payment determination. And in the course of challenging that payment determination, which they thought was because some things weren't matched up correctly, what they found out was that as the PRRB found, the Provider Reimbursement Review Board found, that there were problems that with the matching, that those problems were known to the agency.
Known or should have been known?
The board said that the secretary knew or should have known at least as early as 1993,
right,
that there were problems. But the secretary absolutely.
Does the board in Bay State ever pick time as of which it did become known?
Well, the time was at least as early as 1993.
That's known or should.
Known or should have known. But the secretary, the facts in that case show, with respect to the issue of the use of the Social Security numbers, that the secretary stated in 1986 that she was going to use Social Security numbers to make this calculation, and the secretary never used those numbers. So the secretary knew in 1986, stated that something was going to be done, and that thing was never done. That thing with the matching of the Social Security numbers was not done until just a few years ago as a result of the Bay State decision. So that even if the court would focus on the matching issues where the board said that the government should have known in 1993, there was actual knowledge that the statement about the use of Social Security numbers from 1986 was incorrect. What this means is that the hospitals could not have known. There is no one has articulated any way that the hospital should have been more diligent to find out about these things that only came out in the course of the discovery. In other words, the facts that we're focusing on for equitable tolling is not the fact that the payment determination was made incorrectly. That's what the purpose of the appeal statute is for. But what we're focusing on, two things, what the government secretary knew or should have known about the mismatching, and the government's statements about what it did that it ultimately didn't do, and those two things had the effect of depriving the hospitals of the notice that...
Have you raised equitable estoppel?
We have not raised equitable estoppel. We're focused exclusively on equitable tolling.
No.
And we're the tolling of the 180-day... Right. The 180
Tell me about the petitioners in Bay State. Why were they onto something that you weren't onto?
Well, the petitioners in Bay State were onto a concern that the data that was used, the actual matching that was used, was incorrect. And they doggedly pursued that for a number of years and ended up having a lengthy hearing before the provider reimbursed.
And now you get the benefit of their, if you prevail on equitable tolling, you get the benefit of their litigation. Do you see what I'm getting at? What should you have been as diligent as they were on this issue and maybe have brought your claim at an earlier time?
Well, and it's certainly a fair question. Because we have diligence with respect to the Medicare payment issue is one thing, but we'd like to focus the court on the diligence on what came out. In other words, what came out of that hearing. In other words, the Bay State hospitals went in thinking they were going to find that there was some mismatching, but what they found was government concealment and a fundamental misrepresentation of what had been happening. And so it was at that point that the hospitals then realized, the appellants here, that they had been misled. And the question is, should something happen or should nothing happen? And their answer was, yes, something should happen. And what is that something? Well, we think that the time for us to appeal should be equitably tolled until such time as we have had because of these actions by the secretary. So as a result, the hospitals, through their normal diligence, again, the normal process is they ask for payment. They then get a payment, and then they see if that payment matches up with what they've requested, was thrown a kilter because we're in this special circumstance. Congress has not shielded it from judicial review, and we have the government misrepresenting, and at least as early as 1993, know or should have known.
Back to Bay State, if we may.
Yes.
Did the Bay State complainants find that the mismatching, which they suspected and brought them in, had actually happened independently of this other anterior problem?
Yes. Yeah, that yes.
That happened.
Yes, Your Honor. That came out of the Bay State, that there were very technical mismatching, much of which, the vast majority of which, led from the fact that Social Security numbers were, in fact, not used. Instead, they used this Medicare number.
Maybe hopelessly abstract. Is it possible to disentangle the sort of quantity of underpayment attributable to the mismatching versus the quantity of underpayment attributable to non-use of the Social Security numbers?
I think that the hospitals understand that quantitatively the non-use of Social Security numbers was responsible for the bulk of the payment problem on this thing. And that was, again, a Federal Register document that said that Social Security numbers were being used, which are unique to every person, as opposed to the Medicare number, which is not unique, which depends on whose number Medicare entitlement arises, so it could be a spouse or a dependent as well. But I believe, Your Honor, that quantitatively it related mostly to the Social Security number. So because judicial review is available, obviously without judicial review, the whole concept of proving an equitable tolling claim could not come up, and we know that presumptively that equitable tolling does apply, that we ask that this court remand this case back to the Secretary to recalculate their Medicare DSH payments for the fiscal years at issue, and at this point, if there are no further questions from the panel, we'll reserve the rest of our time for rebuttal.
I have one question about these pending cases before Judge Bates.
Yes.
Is he holding them until this appeal is decided?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Marcus, good morning.
Good morning. I'm Stephanie Marcus from the Department of Justice, and I represent APLE, the Secretary of Health and Human Services. This case actually demonstrates why equitable tolling should not be allowed under the Medicare Act. Contrary to appellant's argument, there was no misrepresentation or concealment found here. What's being ignored is that Judge Bates, the very judge who decided this case below, also presided over review of the board decision and the administrator's decision in Bay State and issued an extremely thorough opinion in which there was found no concealment, no misrepresentation, and Judge Bates reiterated that in this very case. So that this has all been reviewed, and plaintiffs...
I'm confused, though. I mean, we have a ruling before us that equitable tolling can't be applied at all.
Yes,
right?
And we agree with that.
So, I mean, if that's the case, why is there somewhere lurking in this courthouse a finding that equitable tolling should not happen even when it's available?
Oh, Your Honor, Judge Bates actually did not reach whether equitable tolling should apply here because he correctly decided that equitable tolling is not available.
That's what I thought.
Yes. However, in reaching plaintiffs' further claims, for example, for mandamus, the district court actually did go ahead and point out that he said, nothing in either of the Bay State decisions reflects the finding that CMS deliberately concealed the data flaws at issue or otherwise engaged in fraud. Rather, the board simply found that CMS knew or should have known. This is on...
Does equitable tolling require deliberate concealment?
It is a very high standard, and there are a lot of reasons...
That high?
I'm not sure it's that high, but again, Your Honor, that
sounds from what you're saying is if what he was looking at with respect to mandamus is different from what he would look at with respect to equitable tolling.
But it's certainly very relevant to what he would look at. And again, this court does not need to reach that because Judge Bates correctly decided that equitable tolling shouldn't apply here under the Medicare Act at all, and we think Brockamp is controlling, as the district court found, because of this case meets all of the factors relevant there, which is there's emphatic statutory language, there's no indication that Congress intended for tolling to apply.
Emphatic statutory language of what?
Of the time limitation. If you go through the Brockamp language and then the language in 1395.00A3, it states in three different ways the 180-day deadline. And we have that set forth in our brief. There's also an additional...
Just a second, before we go too far, how does this compare with the language discussed in Irwin? Every claim shall be barred unless the petition is filed within 6 years. The court says we're not persuaded of the difference between that and some other phrase is enough to manifest a different congressional intent with respect to the availability of equitable tolling?
Well, Irwin was actually the language there was, you're right that they were comparing the language in Title VII to the language Your Honor just quoted, but the starting point there was that was Title VII, where there are comparable claims against the government and private employers. And
so then you're making the contextual argument, not really the language argument.
Well, it's both. I mean, what we're doing is the Supreme Court's decision in Brockamp is subsequent to Irwin. In Brockamp, the Supreme Court recognized that the language where the statute says shall be filed by the taxpayer within 3 years, and then states or 2 years from the time the tax was paid, whichever it expires later. And here...
And it's part of a panoply of statutory provisions limiting taxpayers.
Yes, but in addition to not having the private analog here, also the Brockamp court went on and noted that in addition, there was no evidence that Congress intended tolling, and here we have D.C. Circuit and Supreme Court precedent that confirms that there is, not only is there no indication Congress intended to have tolling, but this court and the Supreme Court have recognized Congress's strong interest in finality in the Medicare context. And the HCA Health Services decision of this court and in the Your Home decision of the Supreme Court, the courts were in determining that there was no review in those cases, no further review in those cases, the court noted that Congress had a strong interest in finality as evidence that by that 180-day time limit. And in fact, this court said that if a provider allows that time to lapse, then Congress didn't contemplate that the provider would get review. So you also have to look at the Supreme Court and this court's decisions interpreting that emphatic language. And secondarily, the court looked at the underlying subject matter. And we have the same, if not even more extreme situation here with the Medicare Act, the complexity of the act, the number of claims filed, the amount of money at stake, and
Is the standard the complexity of the act? I always thought the standard was the precision with which Congress established time limits.
Well, that's in the starting point is with the statutory language, and I think the statutory language is very precise here, but Brockamp went on and looked at the underlying subject matter of the tax code and looked at the administrative burden that the IRS would face if equitable tolling were allowed for refund claims. And similarly, as we pointed out in our brief, where you have, you know, payments of more than almost $500 billion a year in the Medicare system, more than a billion claims. This case alone, as Judge Henderson pointed out, there are cases being stayed with, you know, further providers, further fiscal years. And this, in this case, this is a, this case is particularly illustrative of why it would be a problem, because you have providers waiting for over a decade, missing all applicable time deadlines, and then trying to come in on another provider who was able to timely file a claim, diligently proceeded with that claim, and, you know, after years of administrative proceedings, discovery, and Judge Bates issuing an extremely thorough decision, only now they try to come in and take advantage of that. And we submit that Judge Bates correctly decided that there is no equitable tolling and correctly dismissed the provider's claims in this case.
Counsel, you distinguish Bowen on the ground that, you quote from its language saying that it's a statute designed to be unusually protective of claimants. But if Medicare recipients, who presumably Congress is concerned about, if the providers of the services that the Medicare recipients seek are not paid in full, is there not likely to be a withdrawal of willingness to be a provider?
Your Honor, I think the distinction here is first with the language of Bowen, which is so much more discretionary. And secondly, you're right, we do distinguish it because the Supreme Court said that it was designed to be unusually protective of claimants. The Supreme Court itself has noted in your home that they characterized the providers here, they discussed each of the tens of thousands of sophisticated Medicare provider recipients of these NPRs is generally capable of identifying an underpayment in its own NPR within the 180-day time period.
But that's not the case here. Right.
Well, Bay State was able to do that, and
let me ask you about that. You don't question the proposition that Bay State went after, first place, another conceptually distinct error.
Well, it
right?
was.
I mean, just.
The Bay State, Judge Bates very helpfully summarizes his holdings in Bay State at the end of his district court opinion in the Bay State matter, not this matter. And there were a number of things at issue, a couple of which CMS actually prevailed on, a couple of legal issues, and one of which was a claim regarding the standard for counting days attributable to patients entitled to benefits under Medicare Part A, which Judge Bates actually dismissed because it wasn't preserved. The ones that were deemed preserved all related to the data CMS was using to calculate the SSI fraction in this in the Medicare fraction of the DSH adjustment. For example, one of them was the matching, but there was also, as Judge Bates found, that CMS failed to use the best available data because it didn't use updated tapes that it had available from the Social Security Administration. And it also didn't include, it omitted certain relevant records. And these were all part of the same issue.
I understand that basically this, it's a complicated calculation and a lot goes into it.
Yes.
But what about Mr. Roth's suggestion that in terms of sort of the weight of the underpayments involved here, the particular issue that's before us, use of the wrong numbers, non-use of the Social Security numbers, let me put it that way, accounts for, I forget exactly how he put it, but I think the greater weight of the underpayment.
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I know that, CMS has put out a ruling about how it's implementing and has done that, and I would have to confirm with the agency about that. But again, I don't think the court need reach any of these complicated matters because Judge Bates was correct in dismissing the claims since there should not be equitable tolling allowed in the first place. In any event, even assuming arguendo there just is no demonstration by plaintiffs here that they would be entitled to it. And if the court has no further questions, just ask that you please affirm the district court. Thank you.
All right. How much time does Mr. Roth have? Okay, why don't you take two?
And I'd like you to address Ms. Marcus's argument that this case is like Brockamp. Could you tell us why you think it's not?
Well, the Brockamp factors are articulated emphatically and repeatedly, but I want to step back in Brockamp. Brockamp is an interesting case because what happened in Brockamp is that you had a taxpayer who first issue arose in Brockamp because the taxpayer wrongfully paid money to the IRS and then was untimely in trying to get the money back. So a major distinguishing factor here was in Brockamp there was at heart an error by the taxpayer. Here there was no error. Obviously it is the hospitals that weren't aware that the secretary hadn't done what the secretary said.
Maybe it's a factual distinction, but I'm looking for what the court tells us about the legal issues that we're supposed to look at in equitable tolling when we're dealing with a complex statutory scheme.
The legal issues are emphatically stated in Brockamp. You had the statute stated positively that there's a deadline, and then the reverse of it to say, and no claim shall be permitted after a certain date. Both sides of it.
We have the first part of that, but we don't have the latter part. No claim shall be submitted after a certain part. Is that the distinction?
Correct. And even the first part is simply stated that when the claim shall be brought within this time period, not as emphatically as in Brockamp, the way that the 180 days is laid out. Secondly, in Brockamp, the court found that it had both a procedural and substantive, that the timing of this affected both. In other words, that the timing would affect not only the ability to bring the claim, but the amount of the claim itself under Brockamp and that statute. There is no corresponding substantive position on this substantive effect that we have under 1395A08A3 as well. Third, you have the repeated several times. You don't have that. It's simply there in 1395-00A3. And we have the other factors that are set forth in our briefs that explicate the entirety of the 6511 statute in Brockamp with the 1395-00A3 that we have here. Just a couple of points, Your Honor, your home, absolutely right, Judge Williams said that providers generally know, Even the Supreme Court hedged, and this is the case, and this is the rare case where that generally really comes into play. Equitable tolling has been around for years and years and years, numerous cases all over the country on the Medicare Part A side. A couple of times, like in Bradford, it's been found to apply. Mostly it has been found not to apply. And so the government is inviting the court here to really go and prohibit something that has been part of the jurisprudence in the Medicare Act for many, many years, and that we ask the court to decline, particularly in the context of this Bowen extremely protective aspect, because here we're talking about a payment for indigent that goes to hospitals that serve indigent patients. If there's nothing more, thank you.
All right, thank you.